From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
It's a lot better than being incarcerated. I like fresh air. You know, when you're incarcerated, you can't get a lot of fresh air, but I'm out here doing well, no trouble. Since I got this, you know, less trouble, stay focused, come to work on time.
Spending time outdoors can be as emotional as it is physical. Today we hear from former inmates who now work in nature and my interview with the first Latina to run the Girl Scouts, Ana Maria Chavez.
There's a growing demographic of girls, Latinas, African Americans of multiracial backgrounds who don't have an affinity because their mother wasn't a Girl Scout, there's not a troop in their local community. What's going to happen in 20 years?
Plus Frida Kahlo in the Bronx, fishing in the middle of a metropolis, and a lot more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about the great big and little outdoors. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So if you're a fan of our show, how about if you take a listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names and the best-kept secrets in hip-hop, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA, everyone. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and you may not know this, although maybe you suspect it, but I am a Frida Kahlo fanatic. I'm not the only Frida Kahlo fanatic out there, and I'm not the only one in our office that feels that way. Our intern, Gabriela Sierra Alonso, is a big Frida fan too, right, Gabriela?
Yes, I am. Hi, Maria.
So recently, Gabriela and I went to check out a Frida Kahlo exhibit in the Bronx, and it was there that we bonded with other fellow Frida fanatics.
She was comfortable in her own skin, and she didn't care about what anyone else thought. Like, and I'll tell you that I'm newly exposed to Frida. Like, I found out that we share the same birthday, and then I just started falling in love with her. And I have so much to learn about her, but just looking at the quotes that she had and just, like, how she talks about madness and how she wishes that she can just, you know, be in this, like, other world where she can just be herself and she doesn't have to, like, keep up with appearances or, like, society. Like, I thought that was so powerful and beautiful.
I think the big thing about Frida is that she represents the artist in all of us in so many ways, right?
Right. I think the whole reason why Frida is so overwhelmingly popular is because she just sort of embraces her truest self. And that's something that is so challenging for so many of us.
You know, I actually was Frida Kahlo inspired for what I wore on my wedding day. And so I wore a Tijuana outfit and the whole headgear from Frida for my wedding, which was about 25 years ago.
You and I are of different generations. And yet Frida has had such an immense impact on the both of us.
Which is why I loved talking to this little boy at the Frida exhibit.
I think I really just liked her reality, like the way she painted her pictures to, like, so much detail. I draw, but I'm not as good as her, but it's kind of like an inspiration to look forward to, like, oh, I want to be able to one day draw like her.
You know, that was the coolest thing about being in this exhibit, was seeing all the little kids. I think she feels like, you know, like a character that you want to get to know more. I think that's why little kids like her.
Her work is so unique in nature that it draws the attention of everybody.
At this exhibit, Frida's biography isn't actually the centerpiece.
So here we are. We're walking into the botanical gardens, and I think we have a little golf cart that is waiting for us to take us to tour this, which is just the thought of being in the Bronx in a golf cart is kind of funny and strange. Hello.
It looks like a radio person.
It looks like a radio person.
Hi.
Hi.
Gabriela.
Gabriela.
I have to because I've been emailing her. Hi, Maria.
How are you?
That's Gail and Karen. They're with the Botanical Garden, and they led us through this special exhibit called Art Garden Life. So instead of just walking around a gallery, we were actually riding through lush greenery And we ended up in this reimagining of Frida's garden at the Casa Azul, which is her home in Mexico. And it was a part of Frida that I had never gotten to see before, which was their goal.
We sort of struggled a little bit in the beginning because people want to tell the same story about Frida over and over again. They want to talk about her biography. They want to talk about trolley car accidents and polio and miscarriages and amputations and tawdry affairs with everyone and their brother. And we don't want to talk about that. Like, there's plenty of information about Frida and her life and her life curated and the things that made her feel comfortable when she was homebound. And so much of that was her nationality and her connection with nature.
Estoy oliendo algo y huele a México. I say that sometimes. Huele a México. It smells like Mexico. And I'm having that experience right here. So what is it that I'm smelling?
It's usually when people say they have a smell right here, it's usually that jasmine that's climbing up that post right there.
You know, the other thing about Frida is that she loved to paint, but her life was art. It's like a whole other way of looking at her art in the context of nature.
I felt it was so immersive. I mean, I think when you go and you see a Frida exhibit anywhere else, it's about looking at her paintings and just feeling that intrigue. And for this, it was more of like an experience. We also talked to other visitors.
A lot of her artwork has gardens in the background, and you always see like the plants in the hair, and it's nice to actually, you know, contextualize it. Like, okay, that is an actual plant. And then to see the actual plant and think of how that plant might have inspired her, or how she was a part of that, and how her artwork was so stimulated and focused within the natural landscape.
We saw the calla lilies and the succulents, and apparently a common reaction is that people will describe this exhibit as exotic. But you and I didn't really feel that way.
So the notion of exotic, I wonder how Frida would have thought about that. Have you heard?
It wasn't exotic to her, it was her life. It was her heritage. It was her nationality. It was normal to her, and it was special, and it was something that she promoted.
And that seems to be what you're getting from many of your Latin American or Latino visitors, that they're saying this doesn't feel exotic. It feels
like home. It feels normal. It feels like, why have we been missing this for so long? It's right here.
And when you hear people say that who are visiting, like, wow, my God, I'm here at the Bronx Botanical Garden, I feel like I'm at home, what does that do for you?
It makes me a little weepy, and I'm not a weepy person. No, it's amazing. It's amazing, because that's what we strive to do.
So I've seen a lot of Frida's work, most of it, and often, in Mexico. But to see Frida's work in the context of a Latino experience in the Bronx, and in that sense, it was Frida kind of like crossing the borders, right? It wasn't just Mexicanos. It was Dominicans and Cubans and Colombianos and Chilenos. Her ability to cross borders was just so present.
I think growing up Latina here in the United States, you tend to place yourself within a greater Pan-Latin identity. Even though, you know, my family is from Cuba and Puerto Rico, this was an exhibit that sort of brought Mexico to life, but I still felt at home. And I wasn't the only one that felt that way.
Like, I feel like I'm experiencing like what she felt and like the experience she's went through, like just the plants, even the smell, really. It's just like, it's like I'm there. Like, it's kind of like my ancestors, like they're where they used to live, which is like, it feels good for me because it's like I can like visit my roots.
Has anybody ever told you that you're like really smart?
Yeah.
They have?
They told me that I'm too mature for my age.
That what?
I'm mature.
This boy was 11 years old, and he was the best to interview.
It was so much fun, Gabriela, hanging out with you at the New York Botanical Garden and with Frida and all of her nature. So it was fun, no, Gabriela?
It was one of the most memorable days I've had this year.
Thanks so much for being there with me.
Thanks so much, Maria.
Being incarcerated is often referred to as being inside, and everything else is life on the outside. But thanks to a program called the Green Team, some inmates are coming home from prisons in New York and now spending their newly free days outdoors. That's because the Green Team trains them in landscaping and gardening. Sarah Barrett brings us this audio postcard.
My name is Amy Kirby. I am a field supervisor and master gardener. The Green Team is an internship program that the Horticultural Society of New York runs, and we build green space projects throughout New York City, whether it be plazas or we're working in parks or residential spaces like this one at Castle Village. Our program is for ex-incarcerated individuals and at-risk youth.
Hi, I'm Jason Manning from the Bronx. It's a lot better than being incarcerated. I like fresh air. You know, when you're incarcerated, you can't get a lot of fresh air, but I'm out here doing well, no trouble. Since I got this, you know, less trouble, stay focused, come to work on time. You know, I'm not on the streets hanging out because I got work in the morning, so it's better.
It's all about the training that you get and being outside, and it gives it an opportunity to learn about the outdoors, and it's very therapeutic and beneficial. Jason comes from GOSO, Getting Out, Staying Out, and he is working in this garden bed weeding today. So we have to make sure we get all of that out. You have to go super hard on it.
View is beautiful. You see the nice water, the boats, and all the birds. And
oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice.
My name is William Cruz. I'm from Brooklyn. For me, I needed it because, you know, with a lot of the traumas that I've had being incarcerated, and you know, like in the anxieties and stuff like that, you know, you wake up, you know, you probably got to wake up like at 4:30 in the morning to get breakfast. If you don't need it, you just miss it. And especially if you don't have no money, you know, like it's hard. So a lot of people are hungry most of the time in there, and the food is terrible. You try to find like ways to like keep your sanity. This was something that, you know, like just by chance, it just happened to help out with what I was going through. So I got lucky, I guess. Like.
Some people come without really being interested in it, and they leave being very interested in it, or, you know, and I think that's kind of the situation with Jason and William. They've really never done this kind of thing before, so every day they're learning something new, and I was actually just telling them about the morning glories, and they were like, what is this? So I was explaining that to them, and they were like, oh, wow, and William's holding these morning glories in his hand, and they're like, they're so beautiful, and it's kind of those moments that when you're outside and you're explaining something and you see their eyes light up and go, I had no idea. And now you know this new thing about the world.
We just go everywhere, all around, it's always different. And it's always just like, when we get there, it kind of looks dead. Like a lot of things are dead. And then when we leave there, it just looks completely different. And that's the best part. It's just like after, it's the best part. I like to do this a lot. It's fun for me. We work hard, and you know, like we try to get the place like looking like the way they look in books and stuff like that. It looks real nice.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Long before any federal law asked us to desegregate our troops, we did that. Some of our first Latina troops were in Texas in the 1940s.
My interview with the first Latina to run the Girl Scouts, Ana Maria Chavez. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Sol se escondió y no quiso salir, debió despertar y le dio miedo de morir. La Abriste los ojos y el sol guardó su pincel, porque tú pintas el paisaje mejor que él. Cuando amanece tu lindura, cualquier constelación se pone insegura. Tu belleza huele a mañana y me da de comer durante toda la semana. Tus ojos hacen magia, son magos, los abriste y ahora se reflejan las montañas en los lagos. La única verdad absoluta es que cuando naciste tú a los árboles le nacieron.
Hey everyone, I wanted to talk to you for just a quick moment in between the podcast listening. First of all, thanks for listening. We're so happy that you're here. And we want to let you know that we have a lot of new listeners. And many of you have actually helped them find us by rating and reviewing our show on iTunes. So if you haven't done that, please do. It's really a big help. Now, I bring it up because a lot of people don't know that Latino USA has actually been around for a long time, even though we've only had our hour-long format for about 2 years. But since then, we've noticed something. The fan mail we get has gotten much more specific and passionate. So I want to tell all of you that it's an honor to me and to my hardworking staff that so many of you feel this way. Some of you have let us know just how you feel by sending your kind words along with a donation. So, you know, we're a nonprofit, and even the smallest donations help us to go and find and tell the stories that you want to hear. So if you can afford it, please go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. Remember, it doesn't matter the amount. It just matters that you send one. Even if you can't donate, I want to make sure you know that we are so happy you're listening. Muchas gracias, everyone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl. With flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide, more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Independent Sector, a national network for nonprofits, foundations, and corporations of every mission and size committed to advancing the common good. More information is available at independentsector.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When it comes to girls and the outdoors, it's hard to think of a more American tradition than joining the Girl Scouts. From First Lady Michelle Obama to former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, countless American leaders have been part of a Girl Scout troop. In 2011, Ana Maria Chavez, a Mexican-American lawyer from Eloy, Arizona, became CEO of the Girl Scouts. She's the first Latina or woman of color ever to lead the organization. Ana Maria Chavez studied history at Yale and law at the University of Arizona and went on to work for the federal and Arizona governments before returning to the Girl Scout movement in 2009. And her leadership might actually be a glimpse into the future. A recent report by the Girl Scouts on the state of girls predicts that by 2030, one in three girls in the country will be a Latina. I invited Ana Maria to talk about her story in the Girl Scouts and about the challenges of bringing more girls of color, especially Latinas, into the Girl Scouts. Ana Maria, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start off by asking about your personal story. What was it like to grow up in Arizona when you were a kid?
Yes. So it was a farm town, but literally the cotton fields were a block away. So I played in the cotton fields growing up. So for us, the outdoors was just an extension of our life. And it also provided the substance for us to live. So it was very organic and inherently connected to our everyday life. My mother was very vocal in local politics. My grandmother, although from Mexico, very inspired to ensure that her children and her grandchildren got an education, were part of the American fabric. My dad was from Mexico, and he was that's how he got to Eloy, because he was a farm worker, and that's how my parents met. My parents talk a lot about how they learned resiliency in the fields and understood what hard work looked like. And even though there were indicators around us just because of poverty line data and, you know, the fact that we were in rural Arizona, people said, well, there are barriers for their success. And my parents didn't see it that way, actually. They saw our community as very tight-knit, very supportive of the kids. And we loved it. It's a great place to grow up.
And who suddenly, or was it you, that just says, you know, I want to become a member of the Girl Scouts?
Well, actually, my best friend came to school, and she said, oh, I'm going to be a Girl Scout. And I'm like, well, I want to be a Girl Scout. And she started gathering our close circle of friends to join the troop. And so, of course, I had to do this. So I go home and try to explain this in Spanish to my grandmother, who had absolutely no conception. I mean, everybody knew Girl Scouts. Son las muchachas que venden las galletas, right? The girls who sell the cookies. But other than that, I mean, it wasn't part of our family history. But as I explained to my family what that meant, they saw it as a leadership opportunity. Now, what they didn't expect is that I would really get involved in environmental justice issues. So I came back so charged up as a Girl Scout at 12 years old that I basically told my mother, you know, I was very upset about certain things that were happening. I found this cave on this, it's a peak called Picacho Peak, and these kids had graffitied all over it, and I was very upset. And so I come tromping down the hill with my little science kit, and my mother's like, ¿Qué pasó? What happened? I said, Ma, graffiti. Unfair. We got to protect the environment. That's what I learned in Girl Scouts. And she went, well, mijita, what are you going to do about that? And I said, well, somebody's got to stop it. They've got to pass a law. And she said, well, mijita, who does that? I said, well, lawyers. Well, Ana Maria, what does that mean? I guess I'm going to law school. So, you know, age of 12, there I am on my path. And, you know, it was such a blessing.
So was your Girl Scout troop mostly Latinas?
No, very diverse.
It was very mixed.
Oh, yeah. There was the, never forget it, the daughter of the local deacon. They were my friends. So they were all different ethnicities, backgrounds, religions, very diverse. So that's why we're very proud that from the very beginning, we were very diverse. Actually, in the 1940s, long before any federal law asked us to desegregate our troops, we did that. Some of our first Latina troops were in Texas in the 1940s. So we have a very long history. I think our issue has been we haven't really talked about it.
And in so many ways, when people mix up Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, actually Girl Scouts have been really progressive.
Absolutely. We always have. And we've always been global.
But your numbers are actually challenged right now.
Absolutely. And since actually it's over a decade that we've been declining in membership. And here's why. We can't get enough adults to volunteer. And so for us, it's how do we get to the adults? How do we share the message about Girl Scouts? I mean, Girl Scouts has built the leadership pipeline for females in the United States for 100 years. So if the pipeline is not being fed today, and there's a growing demographic of girls, Latinas, African Americans of multiracial backgrounds who don't have an affinity because their mother wasn't a Girl Scout, their grandmother was a Girl Scout, there's not a troop in their local community because of lack of volunteers. What's going to happen in 20 years?
So the Girl Scouts are facing some challenges. You kind of represent the new face, the new demographic. How do you understand the fact that this very progressive, diverse, forward-thinking organization didn't have a woman of color until you were named in 2011?
2011. I think because, again, our community doesn't think about joining. Women of color, I don't think, have thought about taking on leadership roles in our organization. And so, again, don't present themselves as potential candidates to take over these roles.
Are you kind of staking your claim in that the future of Girl Scouts is actually bringing in more and more Latinas? So are you doing a targeted approach at all?
Absolutely. And actually, we're focused on parents specifically because we realize more and more parents, single parents, grandparents raising grandkids, they're looking for opportunities for their children. And as, you know, things get tough in the economy, they start cutting back resources. And what we've also seen, school districts have been cutting back in after-school activities. So we're at a wonderful answer to that opportunity. Girl Scouts provides all sorts of activities. So whether you're into the outdoors, great, we've got that. That's been part of our DNA. We've been green for 100 years. Or if you're focused on science, technology, engineering, math, we have girl programming that's very focused on that.
So what is the message to young Latinas?
That Girl Scouts is an organization for them. That even though maybe their mother or grandmother wasn't part of the organization, that it's a great opportunity. It was an amazing opportunity for me. Thousands of Latinas have been part of our organization, have gone on to do great things. But more importantly, it's an organization that really taps into your passion. So whether you're a Girl Scout for 2 years or 10 years, it makes an impact. And over the last few years as the national CEO, you know, I've had the ability to travel all over the world. I recently went to Puerto Rico, where I went to speak to the alum there, because we have a very long history of Girl Scouts in Puerto Rico. And I was giving my speech in Spanish on stage, and then I finished my speech and stunned silence, like nothing. I'm like, oh my gosh, I must have really screwed up. You know? This must have been a really bad speech. And then all of a sudden, they jumped up and it was standing ovation and they were crying. And it dawned on me, and they told me later that it was the first time in decades that one, a national leader, the CEO of our movement, had been to Puerto Rico to speak to the members there. And two, it was the first time ever that it had been done in Spanish. But I realized that it was marking a piece of history for us. And when I got back, I took my speech, I put it in the archives, because I hope it doesn't become the first. It becomes one time of many, that we think about the communities we're serving and that all people of all backgrounds sees us as an organization they want to join.
Ana Maria, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
That was Ana Maria Chavez, CEO of the Girl Scouts. We'll hear from her again later on in our show. So, people, one of my favorite things to do outdoors is to ride my bike, usually through Central Park. But riding in a major city, you know, dodging the cars and the traffic, can be a challenge. It takes a lot of skill, especially on roads that aren't built for biking. From Brazil, Milena Spitzer tells us about a group of bikers trying to fix that problem.
I'm on my bike on a busy highway in Florianópolis, a city of nearly 500,000 people in southern Brazil. Buses, cars, trucks, and motorcycles whiz by, and I must admit, I'm a little nervous. There are no bike lanes. Luckily, I'm not alone.
Pode ir à direita. Já sabes, não, tu entras e vai.
That's Ana Destri, my very own bike angel. She tells me to get over to the right and to change gears when I want. She scolds me for biking on the sidewalk, which I am reminded is only for pedestrians. Back on the road, I get some encouragement. That's right, go ahead, she says. I'm protecting you.
Isso, estou te protegendo.
A bike angel, or in Portuguese, bike anjo, is an experienced city biker who volunteers to help Brazilians of all ages learn how to ride a bike, navigate traffic, and safely commute. On my commute, I have a close call with a big truck. My bike angel warns me to get out of the way. Bike Anjo's mission is to provide a sort of guardian angel on wheels that makes city biking more accessible. It all started with a few friends in Sao Paulo, Brazil's largest city. They decided that instead of trying to convince people they weren't crazy for riding a bike to work, they would show them how it's done. JP Amaral founded Bike Anjo in 2010. Here he is speaking by Skype from Sao Paulo.
But still, people are afraid of going to the street for the first time and riding a bike.
He says Brazil copied the model of American cities like Los Angeles, building more highways and fewer streets.
And mainly that is because, well, we lost the culture of cycling in the streets, not only in Sao Paulo, but in Brazil in general.
The Bike Angel's idea spread quickly. Soon, JP and his friends were getting calls from bikers in other cities. Today, Bike Anjo has chapters in 200 cities across Brazil and sister programs in Portugal, as well as Sydney and Chicago. The Bike Angel School for Adults is especially popular.
Most of these people are people that never rode a bike before. They couldn't because they didn't have space, they didn't have a bike. The people told them not to.
One of those new riders is 52-year-old Maria José Costa. Maria says she was never able to learn, but imagines the sensation of riding a bike must be really cool. She's envious of her friends who use their bikes to ride on trails or run their errands. I think it's a sense of freedom that's really different from riding in a car, she explains. Although she's never ridden a bike, Maria is clearly a fan. She shows off a bicycle tattoo on her ankle. It's an old-fashioned French model, the kind with a big wheel in front. Today it's raining, but Maria is determined to learn. we find shelter under a raised highway. And veteran bike angel Sergio Fregalón begins with balance exercises in the muddy grass. Maria starts to pedal, but her wheel hits a dip and she falls off the seat. Sergio runs barefoot through the mud and tells her she's doing great, to just keep looking forward. Maria goes at it again with gusto, but falls over sideways, and Sergio catches her. It's okay to scream, he reassures her. It's a good thing you caught me, she says. After a few hours, the rain stops, and now Maria is riding around a parking lot on her own. She's finally got it, that moment of victory when she succeeds in staying up. After the class, Maria tells me she learned something really important. Fear, she says, shouldn't make us stop. It should just make us pay attention. It can't be paralyzing. It should be a yellow light, not a red light. Maria isn't the only Brazilian yearning for the freedom that comes with cycling. The Bike Angels are part of a growing movement to make Brazilian cities more bike-friendly through the construction of bike routes and city bike programs. In Sao Paulo, there's a plan to put in over 800 miles of bike routes by 2030. Bike Angels founder JP Amaral says that's needed.
Mainly because 90% of our emissions and our pollution also is due to heavy use of cars and inefficient motorized vehicles. And now we're suffering the consequences.
Last year, the city went through a record drought. Given all this, mobility options that cut carbon emissions seem like a smart idea. Yet not everyone is in favor of such alternatives.
Nós ajuizamos essa ação, formulamos dois pedidos liminares, para paralisação.
At a recent press conference, Sao Paulo State Prosecutor Camila Magalhães da Silveira put a moratorium on the construction of all new bike lanes in the city, and she ordered all the unfinished bike lanes to be repaved for cars. She says, we have two metro lines and various bus lines. Is the bicycle really going to add anything? Is it going to bring benefits for transit in the long term? That stance caused outrage. In response, thousands of cyclists took to the streets in a bicicletazo, a simultaneous mass protest ride. It took place in 30 cities across Brazil, and also in places like San Francisco, London, and Munich. I go along for the ride in my town.
E nós estamos aqui, mesmo com chuva, na bicicletada Floripa. Critical mass Florianópolis.
The protest ride begins with one of the organizers toting a giant speaker with technicolor lights strapped to the back of his bike. Songs about biking in various languages stream into the crowd as we ride through the dark, wet streets. At the end of our ride, we learn that the moratorium has been lifted. Sao Paulo can finish building its bike routes. Now Florianópolis is hoping to follow suit. City planners and bike activists are working together to make the city more bike-friendly. City planner Vera Gonçalves da Silva says the more bikes on the streets, the safer traffic will be, because cars won't feel like they own the road. The means to that end is a city bike program called Floribike, which will give commuters free access to bikes around the city center. Vera says change won't happen overnight, but there's no way to stay away from a worldwide trend. City biking is catching on. For Latino USA, I'm Milena Spitzer in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Mas não ajuda.
coming up on Latino USA.
Down here, you look up the arroyos, and unfortunately, you see trash. You see abandoned cars. You see basically everything people don't want dumped in there.
People fighting to keep their little outdoors clean. Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So if you're a fan of our show, how about if you take a listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names and the best kept secrets in hip hop, from behind the scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers and artists. Learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985 supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysims.org. And the Embry Foundation, working to expand awareness, explore possibilities, and elevate consciousness through philanthropy and community building.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So living in a city can make enjoying the outdoors just a little bit harder to do. But urban angling, like fishing in a city's parks or rivers, is an easy way to get in touch with the outdoors. Even in New York, opportunities to fish are often hidden among the city's concrete and glass. Latino USA went to Central Park to find out more.
My name is Makita Keys, and I'm 9 years old. I'm getting ready to put fishing rod and a bucket.
Look at that. Oh, right in the pool. What? Future pro,
good
right?
Job.
Future pro.
My name is Michael Iaconelli, and I'm here representing kind of the sport of bass fishing and fishing. I'm a professional angler. I've been doing it for 16 years. Here we are in Central Park in New York City, and you wouldn't really make a connection between that and fishing, but there's a huge connection. So they're having a great time learning the art of casting, but when they leave here, the opportunities to fish are so close.
Finger, bail, okay, and when you, remember, let go of the line. Let go of the line.
Got a kid right there, he's, I'm guessing, 4 years old. He's got a smile on his face. We've got a guy teaching him how to cast, the art of casting, which in itself is fun without a fish even pulling back.
Watch over there when I release the butt. So when you throw it like you were throwing it, passing it, you want to release the button like this.
I'm Kaylee Leanne and I'm 9 years old. Well, over here I was practicing fishing and I kept casting and casting and then I got it into the third pool in the middle that was on the right side of me, and then I hooked a hat, which I got a free hat. Well, it was a lot of fun, and I liked it.
That's
awesome. That is awesome.
You got it in the, that's the grand prize. Awesome.
My name is Steven Leon, and I'm Kaylee's dad. I grew up in the city, so I knew about fishing here in the city. We live up in New Rochelle, so we go up by the high school, New Rochelle High School, the Twin Lakes. We go to the reservoir. We go catch and release at Van Cortlandt Park.
You're the first one today that made it in that one from this side.
There you go.
I'm serious. You're the first one today.
Go for it again. On the side. Try one more on the side. Oh. Watch this.
You know, I think when most people close their eyes and think of fishing or bass fishing, they think of the South. They think of, you know, maybe more southern-based reservoirs in rural areas. And they don't necessarily think of the opportunities that are in cities, in city centers. And there's a huge opportunity in urban areas and city centers for fishing, both freshwater and saltwater. Fishing, the best way I can describe it, it's like a puzzle. And you're competing against not another person, but you're competing against a living creature, a fish. And you have to figure out how to make that fish bite. It's actually the last great sport where you have a natural connection to nature.
He's got a good cast.
Oh! Takes out the cameraman.
No, wait. Do you know where you just threw that?
Shot right there.
14th Street.
You just hit New Jersey. You just hit New Jersey.
Latino USA intern Nomi Nujiadin produced our story. In the Mexican state of Baja California, there's an industrial boom going on. Foreign investment has poured in. Development near the border has grown so fast that it's endangering the coastline of Ensenada, one of Baja's biggest cities. Now a group of cross-border allies is hoping to keep one historic beach from ever seeing commercial development. Sarah McClure has our story.
San Miguel Beach is a paradise of wind and waves. It's a lush oasis right in the middle of one of Mexico's busiest towns, just over an hour from the U.S. border. San Miguel is the birthplace of surfing in Mexico. But what makes it truly special is its arroyo, or creek, that's teeming with plants and wildlife. Tadpoles, pelicans, falcons, rabbits, quails.
En el arroyo, we come here every day. We come, well, almost every day, like four, like five times a week we come down to play.
Eileen Moreno has lived here for 14 years.
It's perfect for the children. And I love it. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Standing between the arroyo and the ocean, biology student Gabriel Juarez explores a tide pool.
Es increíble. Hay mucha vida marina. Por eso él
estuvo
aquí.
It's incredible, he says. There's a ton of marine life. That's why I study here. There are things that you can only find here in Ensenada. But glance up, and suddenly, San Miguel's tranquil paradise isn't so tranquil.
Down here, you look up the arroyos, and unfortunately, you see trash. You see abandoned cars. You see basically everything people don't want dumped in there.
That's because part of the arroyo sits under a busy freeway overpass, says surfer Patrick Whaley, which makes it an easy target for litter bugs. One moment, you're walking around tide pools with sea anemones. The next, you're stepping over plastic containers, beer cans, clothing, even underwear beneath the overpass. But now, people are coming together to care for San Miguel.
Inviting you for a short guided walk of the San Miguel Arroyo.
Today, there's a surf competition going on. Mara Arroyo is at a booth talking to beachgoers. Her family has lived in Ensenada for generations, and she's on a special mission.
Yeah, we're also trying to promote the signature campaign to protect San Miguel's watershed and to make Arroyo San Miguel the first state park in Baja California.
To make San Miguel Baja's first state park, people like Arroyo are trying to draw up a petition of 10,000 signatures from both Mexico and the U.S. The idea is to show the local government how much cross-border support there is to protect the beach. Already, several organizations on both sides are on board, like Save the Waves, Pro Natura, Surf Ends, and Wild Coast.
And the community has to pressure our government officials to actually do what we need.
That's Dr. Edward Najera with Wild Coast. He understands that signatures alone won't turn San Miguel into a state park. For that to happen, both the governor and the Environmental Protection Secretary in Baja California have to approve the proposal. A San Miguel state park would mean legal protection from trash dumping, urban development, and sand mining. Literally, removing sand to make things like concrete.
Development is always welcome, of course. So having more job opportunities, modernizing the city is important. But we need regulations, you know, like we need strong regulations to make sure that we are not destroying what is bringing these investments.
Publicly, the government appears to agree. Baja's environmental officials are in talks with San Miguel's advocates, people from both sides of the border.
Like for the last, I don't know, 50, 60 years, Mexicans and Americans have been living together in San Miguel. Why wouldn't it be a natural thing to do to do it together for to work for its conservation?
Najera says the advocates just want to make sure the government's words translate into action. For Latina USA, I'm Sam McClure in Ensenada, Mexico.
The Colombian band Bomba Estéreo has made a career out of mixing Colombian root sounds like cumbia and champeta with electronic dance beats and psychedelic guitar textures. The band's inspirations come from Colombia's super varied and super rich cultural traditions, as well as from the country's natural beauty. Earlier this year, the band released its fourth album titled Amanecer, which means dawn. Band member Simon Mejia takes us through the process of composing the album's final song, Raíz, or Roots.
The inspiration for that song was having a son, my first son. See, it was like an energy that I never felt before in life. No, it was like in real and pure love. So one day I was in the studio with him in the cradle just beside me, and I started thinking about him, about babies, and about what kind of sounds, frequencies could have like a real effect on them being so small and sensitive. So I started playing with this indigenous maraca, which in Colombia is called sonajero. I don't know why they have a special effect on child and on babies. If they are crying, for example, and you play the thing, they calm down. And then I started playing the guitar. And when I was playing the guitar, I was thinking, how can I play, like, make guitar lines sound very naive? I joined everything with an organ line. And then that was, like, the bass of the song. I finished the demo and I sent it to Liliana. Liliana is the singer of Bomba Estéreo. And she came up with this very, very special lyric about nature, about the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta,
Vengo de la montaña.
Which is a very energetic and powerful mountain we have in Colombia, which is the only place on Earth where you have snow and tropical sea so close. It's crazy to have these different kind of altitudes and environments in just one place. And for the indigenous people, the Sierra Nevada is the heart of the earth. So it's like a sacred place. The lyrics of Raíz are about becoming like a bird. Like an eagle, no, and flying, and then coming back down again and flowing like water.
Soy hija de la tierra.
So it's like more or less one as a human blending with nature and being just one.
Vengo de la montaña.
send the lyrics of Raiz to me, I thought, wow, there's a very deep relation between the idea I had when I was making the song and thinking about my son, of my baby, and what Liliana is singing about. It's like the pureness of both ideas. The energy of nature is like a very pure energy. It's not contaminated by anything of the human world, to say. And a child is the same. It's like the child, besides coming out of a person and everything, is a part of nature. And a child comes in a very pure and a very delicate form of energies. My son is the composer of this, and maybe of the whole album, unconsciously. And actually, when we ended up the whole album and everything, and Ricky, the producer, sent me the master, I get into my car in the garage with my son, who was a little bit bigger, and I play the album like loud in the speakers in the car, and he was dancing all the way. So I thought, okay, yeah, this album is for him.
Our piece on Bomba Estéreo comes from producer Marlon Bishop. Bomba Estéreo's latest album is titled Amanecer. So everyone, today we've heard stories about folks who find the best in themselves outside. In our interview, Ana Maria Chavez, the CEO of the Girl Scouts, told me how she found her career path on the trail with her Girl Scout troop in Eloy, Arizona. To close things off, here's some sabiduría, or words of wisdom, from Ana Maria on the importance of the outdoors for kids today.
This is the first generation of kids that we're actually raising more inside than we are outside. And, you know, I'm raising a son who I adore. And, you know, I'm watching him all the time. Where is he? Where is he going? You know, as you see TV, more and more parents are scared about letting their kids outside the house, and they want their kids to check in all the time. So when we were growing up, right, we would go out, hey, Mom, going out to play. We'd be gone for 5 or 6 hours, especially in Eloy, right? You'd go out, you play in the fields, you jump over bushes. You were out there in the environment, and it was okay. Nowadays, I think parents are concerned about, you know, again, what's going to happen to their kid if they're outdoors, and girls in particular, you know, they like air conditioning. You know, they want the ability to plug in their cell phone. And, you know, our camps are rustic, you know, and we introduce kids back into the environment. And so it's interesting to watch kids outdoors nowadays, that it's unfortunately become not an opportunity that a lot of kids get every day.
So grab that device out of your kids' hands, like I've done many times before, and get them out to the great, or even the little, outdoors. A disfrutar la naturaleza. That's it for this week, everyone. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Gabriela Sierra Alonso, Nomi Nujiadine, and this week we say a fond farewell to two of our interns, the fabulous Polly Dinette-Claw. Polly, we enjoyed having you so much and watching your adventures in New York City.
and we look forward to seeing what skills you bring back to Generation Justice back in New Mexico. Thanks so much, Polly. And we also say goodbye to Isabel Rio Frio. Suerte in your final semester of grad school. Go on and get that degree, Isabel. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen every week, and special thanks to Colin Ashmead Bobbitt and Sarah Liu at WBEZ in Chicago. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima, everyone.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
The lyrics of Rice... Of Rice.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Americans for the Arts. For more than half a century, committed to building better communities and better lives through the arts, in partnership with local, state, and national leaders. Learn more at AmericansForTheArts.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. More information is available at WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.